Okay, internet peoples, this is Frank Kozik, also known as the guy that makes lots of junk for everybody in the world, and you're listening to Master of One Podcast.
Welcome to this Sandbox episode of the Master of One Podcast, part two for this week. This week, we continue our Mold Breaker series with designer toy customizer, Gary Hamm. I'm Andrew, your Master of Art and Design.
I'm Patrick, your Master of Television and Film.
And I'm Luke, your Master of Toys and Games.
So build your best tree fort, climb inside, and get ready for another episode.
And see the stag.
So for this Sandbox episode, we have another special guest, and this, of course, we are in our Break the Mold Toy Customizers series this month, and we have been waiting a long time to talk to this guy. We've talked about his work multiple times. I've gotten pieces from Comic-Con. I got a piece when I was in New York from this guy. His style is unlike any other, and he started off as a customizer. You might know him more now from some of his one-off pieces or his production pieces, but ladies and gentlemen, we are talking finally with Gary Hamm.
Hey, hi, Gary.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for welcoming us.
I think
you're the first one to welcome us, and it feels good. It just feels right.
Hey, I'm a long-time listener, first-time guest. How about that?
Yeah. So we're excited to have you on, and like we said, we've talked about your work quite a bit. I don't know if you can see it over my shoulder, but there's a little Sylvan back there popping his head up somewhere on that shelf. But
he made it up. He just has so many toys you can't tell. So yeah, he'll just say, "I swear, one of yours is back there."
Don't look too hard, but it's
I'll take
there.
Your report.
we'll start you off the way we start off everybody. We know who you are, but maybe some of the people who are listening don't yet know who you are, and you have some new fans just waiting. They're on the cusp of being your new fans, and they need to know who you are. So give us your Wikipedia page. Tell us about who you are, your style, when you started and all that stuff, like walking us through.
Okay. Well, first off, I'm a husband, father of two boys. They keep me busy and running around, and I started doing designer toys. I think I bought my first designer toy around 2003 at San Diego Comic-Con, and that introduced me to it, and for several years I was just fascinated with it. And around 2006, that's about when I produced my first toy, and I've been doing it ever since, and customizing, self-producing toys, done designs for several companies, and that's the short of it.
Okay, so that's a pretty abbreviated version. Some of your work has been featured in some pretty legit places. Talk about some of the places where your custom pieces, like your customized pieces or your original pieces. Talk to us about some of those have been featured and how those came to be.
Okay, I guess the most recent would probably be the Clutter Gallery show where they had the Dunny 2 show. And I was fortunate enough to get an invitation from Clutter and Kid Robot on that. And much to my surprise, a gigantic 20-inch Dunny shows up. And
yeah.
If you guys ever seen one of those things in person, it's a pretty massive piece of vinyl, right?
Yeah.
So
yes.
I had that for a few months deciding, playing around with exactly what I'm going to do with it. And I decided to turn it into a giant treehouse.
Yeah.
And that was a really fun project. And luckily, something on that scale, I was able to hit the wood shop. And how I work is mainly I like to work in wood. I love carpentry. And got a nice little setup out in the garage. And so, revved up the saws and turned the Dunny into a treehouse. And working at that scale, I can work pretty safely. lately, I've been cutting up some smaller stuff in the garage, little 3-inch scales. And I might lose a finger.
It's a little dicey, huh?
I like to live on the edge.
It's for the sake of your art, though, right? I mean, Van Gogh cut off an ear, so I think you're fine just nipping off a fingertip.
Yeah, I'm a little more sane than Van Gogh, but yeah, I might have some kickback from the I actually have, you know, nicked my finger into the bandsaw blade and went to the ER and everything, but no nerve damage or anything, so we're good there.
You have to get one of those, like, I know you've seen them, like, your finger barely touches it and has, like, the saw stop that jams up in and all that stuff.
Are you kidding me? I've seen those. I would love to have a super high-tech workshop like that, but no. I don't have any vacuums. I don't have – when I work in there, I'm just covered in sawdust and –
So if you're listening to the show and you want to contribute to help Gary
Ham, great place to start.
This is a good, yeah. So you can donate at GaryHamNeedsHisFingers.com. We've already set it up. There's a PayPal that goes directly to his.
Send him some Festool gift cards or whatever. So is that white dunny that's on the head that's on the shelf above you, that's from the tapestry?
Yeah, that was the leftover from it. Yep.
Gotcha.
Wow, yeah. Good spot, Patrick. Way to go.
I've been waiting this entire time to ask, just like on the edge of my seat.
All 4 minutes of the interview?
All 4 minutes. So do you have plans? This is a side note. Do you have plans for that head? Do you have like something like running around yours right now?
You know, I don't have any plans, but I have been contacted by people who made the assumption that, hey, Gary didn't use that giant dunny head. Let's see if maybe he would be willing to sell it. Mm. Or maybe I'm willing to customize it for him. So I have, you know, offers on the table. So we'll see what happens.
So what is it about toys? You said you kind of saw your first ones. You got introduced to it in 2003. So this is now 13 years later.
Yep.
What is it about toys that kind of drew you in? Like, what's your background that it felt like this was a natural progression for you?
Okay. So just the toy aesthetic in general is just something I'm extremely drawn to. And my entire life growing up, I always thought I was going to either one day work for Disney or work in animation. So I was in college, I got picked up, I started doing special effects animation work for Fox Animation Studios here in Phoenix. And so I've always had just been drawn to that cartoon nature of things. And when I've always kind of been heavy into collecting. It started with comics, and then I got into toys. It started with Spawn figures and then Simpsons. And I loved the hunt. I would run all over town looking for that impossible figure. And it didn't even have to be a figure back then, it didn't matter if I wanted the figure or if I thought it was cool. It was all about the hunt. Now, my older age and having a budget, I typically only buy toys that I actually like. And sure. So, but back then, that's when it started. You know, 2021, I would decorate my house, was, you know, filled to the tee with shelves of Toy Story figures, Spawn, as you see behind me, that giant Iron Giant. And it was just anything and everything that appealed to me. Every weekend, every night after work, I would hit up Toys R Us and see what I can find. So, I mean, that's really kind of how it started. It was just a love for just cartooning in general and just a love for collecting toys and finding designer toys at San Diego many years later. That's just really when it all changed for me. That just was a big eye opener, and you know, it's been a love affair ever since.
So you got introduced to them at Comic-Con is where you first kind of, you know, stuck a peek at it. So what was it that drew you to Comic-Con that got you there? And then, like, had you been going to Comic-Con pretty regularly? Was this your first time going?
First year going, it was 2003. Actually, back then, I was doing pinup art. And I had met a friend, Dean Eagle, who does Playmory cartoons. He contacted me, and we kind of started up a email friendship. And then we started hearing about San Diego Comic-Con. And back then, it was actually pretty easy, you know, to get a booth. So he and I decided to do our first table together out there, and just around the corner from our table was a booth called Critter Box. And I'm there, they were displaying their first toy, the Pippin Norton toy. I picked it up on the spot. I think it was like $45. Amazing box design, cool figure. And it was over. You know, from then on, I went home and I, you know, researched Critter Box and just started getting designer toys more and more.
Awesome. So I want to talk a little bit more about like, you're one of the only guys, and we've seen a couple people that have dipped into the wood medium. But in the stuff that I remember seeing starting out, you didn't really have much of you weren't really working in wood much. And then it's now that's predominantly more of what you do. So talk a little bit about that transition. Like, how did that come about into woodworking? Have you always been doing woodworking and just translated it into toys more?
Yeah, you know, when I was, even in high school, my favorite class in high school was woodworking. Okay. And I was a skater kid, and my dad was the best dad in the world, super supportive. I mean, he loaded us up with every ramp you can imagine. We had mini pipes, half pipes. We lived in a cul-de-sac, and we would fill the cul-de-sac with railings and launch ramps. So
awesome.
I was really introduced in carpeting through him, just through making ramps. You know, I've made shelving units for the house and nightstands and whatnot. But when I got into toys, initially I just kind of started out designing them, and then I would pay a sculptor to carve them out for me. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it's expensive paying a sculptor, especially sure. when you're self-producing. It's really kind of expensive to actually get a sculptor on board or a 3D artist, and then you're doing 3D printing. And my style just really lends it well to cutting in wood. You know, I can kind of think curves against straights and keep it real blocky and simple. And that's kind of how it kind of happened. Was just a money saving thing, and I can produce more. It was, yeah. I didn't have to wait 6 to 9 months for production to come out. If I wanted to do a small hand run or something like that, I could just run out in the garage on a weekend and carve them out and paint them up myself.
Awesome.
So you're working in wood, but like the Sylvan figure that I have, it feels like wood. It even has like the wood texture to it, but the whole thing is vinyl. So talk to me about that wood to vinyl like conversion and why you decided to make something that was plastic look and feel like wood.
Okay, the Sylvan actually is casted from my wood sample.
Yeah.
So it is picking up the true aesthetics of my wood. It's, you know, got any dents or chips and slight wood grains. So that's probably why it looks and feels like wood. And I started out doing that with the Monster Totems. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that toy. Yeah. 2-inch stackable.
I've got one
monster
of those as well.
Figures. Okay. So that was a figure I actually self-produced, and Pobber, you know, produced the Sylvan figure. But when I went to self-produce the Monster Totem, I decided, you know, again, just to cut corners on, you know, sculpting fees and, you know, carve it up myself and sent it over to China, and they pulled molds right from my wood samples. And that's really how it all came about, was just how easy it was to just run out in the garage and I can carve these things up. And the nice thing about wood too is, you know, 3D printing a lot of things is perfect, right? It's just really polished looking when you do a 3D design and print. With wood, you're kind of getting that one-off look. You're getting the dents and the miscuts and some of the areas where maybe I was lazy on sanding and whatnot. So that's what I like about casting from wood.
Yeah, it's got all that character built into it.
Yep.
It's so funny because you're saying that it kind of naturally happened because it was easier for you, but I'm sitting here like on the consumer side, on the purchaser side, saying, oh, I wonder how much extra time he spent to make this thing feel like it was wood. Like, so
yeah,
I kind of feel like that's a win-win.
So one of the hard things about wood is
it's wood.
I could just cast from it, but let's say I want to do a small run of all wood fingers, I literally have to hand cut every piece. You know, I don't have a CNC router machine or anything
yet
that's gonna help me. So
yeah, again, Gary Ham needs his fingers .com and you can donate.
Yeah, so if someone wants to send me $40,000 to buy a nice CNC machine, okay.
Yeah, well, but, it's funny. I wasn't the main point of contact. A lot of time when we're setting up guests, I tend to be typically the person that reaches out first. And in this case, Andrew was. But Andrew shared some of the conversation. And I think one of the things you said was something along the lines that you didn't like necessarily – you weren't doing a lot of customization now, I guess, or that you weren't sure if you would really consider yourself a customizer. You chopped up a 20-inch dunny and turned it into a treehouse. Like, I'm not sure what part of that is not a customizer.
No, here's the thing is, I don't know how to categorize it, but there's definitely people, guys in the scene that I would say are customizers. They're full-time customizers. They love it, they breathe it, and they're passionate about it. I wouldn't say that I'm passionate about customizing. I do enjoy doing it when I do it, but it's not something like I'm dying to do. I'll do it when I got the right idea or if the right show came up or something like that.
Sure.
But generally, it seems like when I get, you know, a lot of people ask, do you have a custom list, a customizer list, and how do I get on that list? And I'll think like, man, I just don't want to fill up my my free time with customs because sure. I need it to focus on either designing other things and whatnot. So that's one reason I don't consider myself a customizer so much because I don't feel like I don't do it full time enough to do it. But, you know, I think drills and, you know, Squeenk and these other guys are really, right. They're living it and that's how they're making their living is through customizing. So I guess that's why I don't consider myself a customizer per se.
So, and I want to ask you one more because I know we're about to leave this conversation and go off and do other stuff, but just real quick I guess you're the first person that I've seen that's doing like displays. I mean, really, like if you look at like the Autumn Stag or something like that, like these are big toy displays. And I think that's awesome because, yeah, we can all go to, you know, Target and get some little three-tiered acrylic shelf, but or we can get this big freaking, like, animal with these giant horns, and it's just so dramatic and but still, like, whimsical and cool. And so I was curious, is that something that, like, you were trying to be strategic about of, like, I see an opening for something that people aren't doing? And then the second part of that is, what are there like structural considerations that you have, or are you just like you build it and hope it stands up in the end, or like what's a little bit of that process?
So visualize when I, you know, come up with that concept, I know in my head that it's going to work. I mean, I already know the cuts and the designs and the assembly. And so I know it's going to work. Well, when you go to the scale of the Autumn Stag, I mean, have you seen it? Any of you guys seen it in person?
Never in
it's
person.
It's pretty massive. So I want to say it's maybe 30 inches tall, and it holds a lot of toys. But when I was designing it, you know, it was designed for, you know, the idea that it's going to be designed to hold the typical 3-inch minifigure. But going with the antlers, you know, 3 inches, let's say I have 3 or 4 rows of antlers, just the antlers alone are probably, you know, 20 inches of it. So it is a massive figure, and I ideally would like to get the price point down to where the average toy collector could afford it. I mean, right now, the first run of the large one we did, it's not something that everyone could certainly afford.
I was doing my best to try to make it happen, but instead I decided to stay married.
So. Yeah, exactly. No, it's a shame. I would hear people say, I have to ask the wife or and whatnot. And that's a shame that we couldn't reach the everybody market. But with Pauper, we have discussed a mini stag figure. It's not going to be able to hold as many figures, but it's going to be a counterpart to the giant stag. And so anyone who actually owns the current Autumn Stag, it should be a nice, you know, piece to go along with it. And so hopefully we can make that happen.
Will it be small enough that it could go on the big stag?
No. Okay. No. I think it's going to be big enough that's going
to
fit on
the small. You have to make a mini.
Yeah, a mini. Well, I'll have to make a mini.
Yeah, you can do a 3-inch stag. Yeah, yeah. To go on top of the – yeah, I'm all about that.
I'll risk cutting my fingers to make a 3-inch.
Well, no, by then we'll have raised enough money. It's fine. Yeah, it's all going to be taken care of by then.
Yeah. You know what? I should probably reach out to like you know, Inkit Lab. She does really nice work with the wood where she can actually print on the wood. You know, something like mini stag like that, that would be a really cool little figure to produce. And she would be the one to do it because I wouldn't have to spend time painting. The problem with going so small on stuff like that is the price point.
Sure.
Because really going 3 inches or 9 inches isn't really any difference in time for me. It's no difference in product, you know, in an really material cost. But the paint the two, it's almost about the same time. But people are going to look at a 3-inch figure and say, I don't want to spend more than $40 for that. But if I make something in 9 inches, I can make it, you know, a little more worth my while.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, makes sense to me. So we've been talking these past couple weeks with some people, designers specifically. Like, we talked with Brock, who Outerbacher out at Mondo, who does all the toy stuff, and we talked to him about pricing and how he prices things in the market. And then last week we talked with Frank Montano about his pricing structure and how, you know, quantity and then price point. So how do you approach that? Maybe not necessarily on your production figures, or maybe give us an example of your production line and then more of a smaller run. What do you do to pick a price point?
Sure. Okay. Well, we'll do both. We'll do production. And so first production, ideally, I like to make things as affordable as possible. I would rather get more product into people's hands than have a stockpile of stuff that was priced too high.
Yeah.
And so when I price a production toy, when I was self-producing, basically contact the distributor, you know, find out what their percentages were. And basically I would price it to be pretty much double what the distributor is, right? So sure. I'm not making really much money on the distributor sales, but they're getting it into the stores. So, and what I now would think of what product I could sell my own store, you know, that's potential profit for me. And then the distributor is kind of a break-even point, and they're the ones getting to the stores. So that's where the pricing for that product is. It's basically double. So, you know, distributor might say, well, actually, stores, you know, will probably get like a 50% off rate going through the distributor.
Yeah.
So if it, you know, it's an $80 toy, the distributor is going to want $45, you know, and whatnot. And a personal, when I do micro runs on my own or just in general, just a custom, I kind of price of just kind of what my time really came down to. Usually the stuff, if I broke things down hourly, I'm probably not even making the minimum wage.
Yeah.
But it's just a, you know, a thing of passion. And I, you know, I think you know, time away from family. And unfortunately, we had to think about taxes and gallery costs. When you look at that 20-inch, you know, Denny that was at the Clutter Gallery, yeah, it seems super expensive to a lot of people. But then you take the gallery fees, and then I'm going to hit with taxes on top of that. You know, all of a sudden, done, that's probably a minimum wage deal.
Yeah.
Sure. Especially, you know, at the product. And as far as the other mini series, again, it's just kind of what, you know, time comes down to.
Yeah.
You kind of, I don't want to price too high. I try not to break the bank. You know, I know a lot of collectors out there. I do have a, you know, a pretty good fan base as far as collectors where I know they have deep pockets, but I don't want my product only going to them. You know, I want to, hopefully I can get someone who's been wanting a piece for long enough and again, I can keep it in their price point. And that's really important to me, is to hit all fan bases. I don't want to just tap into the super collector who has deep pockets.
And well, I think that's admirable. And we heard a similar thing from Brock the other day when we were talking, when he reminded us or informed us that he's a collector too. And and even though, right, even though it's a business and you're trying to make a living, you certainly don't want to lose money. You also don't want to get lost in the money, and you want to be able to, like you said, get it as many people hands. When you're talking about, you're taking less of a cut when a distributor is doing it, but a distributor is getting it in the stores. When you do distributor work, are you considering it as more of a way to get your name out there and more of a promotional type thing, and less of a money making area in your business strategy?
No, because really what you need is you need a distributor. I mean, the designer toy scene is still really small, and it's hard to move a lot of product by yourself. I mean, when I first came in, my first toy, I think I had 600 main, and I was a no-name. I mean, there was no one had any reason to know why I made – I came from pinups. All of a sudden, I'm making, you know, a cute little rabbit character, right?
Yeah.
And so that was just a real just kind of passion project for me, and whether, you know, that sold or not, it didn't really matter to me. But because I was a no-name, people weren't coming to me for sale. So it was important for me to get a distributor who could get it out to the stores, who could, you know, get it out to the, you know, out to the public. And that's how you do it at that time, through distribution. And I really think distribution is really important for the scene, and the designer toy scene's in this weird place right now, where a lot of toy designers are going through crowdfunding and actually doing pre-orders themselves, which is great. It's great that it's really kind of independent, but in a way that's sort of taking out the store distributor aspect. Because if someone's doing a Kickstarter, I would think that most stores are kind of assuming that anyone who already wanted to pre-order it
Right.
Why am I going to spend the money to bring it into my store?
Right.
Or if, you know, artists are doing pre-sales, again, you already did a pre-sale. Why is the store, you know, Rotofugi now going to want to stock that toy?
Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting thing that's going on right now.
Hey, can you talk to us about what your you've got these different things that you've worked on? You I've seen some of your older work, and you have like these pinup vinyl figures, right? These pinup girls, and then you've shifted to a little bit more of this what I would consider a very it's a unique style, but beyond that, it's a very
magical
at a glance.
Forest chic.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good use of it. But at a glance, you know it's you. I mean, everything you put out these days seems like it's quintessentially you. And what is it? What has it taken to kind of shape your aesthetic to the place where you really feel like, at least do you feel like you've hit a stride? And this is where you're going to stay for a while, or do you feel like you're going to shift again and morph again into something else?
Right. No, when I was doing pinup, it was, man, I was just obsessed with it. It was pinup every day and night. And but there was always deep down inside me, and it's kind of like a children's book illustrator. I just love just drawing simple kitty stuff. But there's the guy in me who also liked doing the beautiful female form. But then, you know, I don't know what happened. When I discovered designer toys, just my interest in pinups really went to the wayside, and I just started drawing. Honestly, it was just more about toys. It wasn't even about just drawing for the sake of drawing anymore. It just became about designing toys. And even today, I don't sit here and just draw to doodle, or, you know, I'm not a painter. I don't think of what my next canvas is. It's, for me, it's all about toys. It's, if I doodle, it's could this be a plush? And like, I kind of, when I draw it, I'll just do turnarounds of a plush or the wood figures. And it's, for me, it's all about toys and the toy aesthetic. And I do sort of feel that over the years, I have developed, you know, a pretty good style, and it's mainly based on my wood cutting style. And there are times where I do, if I'm not thinking wood cutting, I'll do a design, say like the Wooper Looper or the Carrot Jake Jake, where I can't do it, but it's more 3D, somebody else can sculpt it. But it's, I think that's still me. It still has that cute whimsical that my wood stuff has. It just has a slight different aesthetic. It's not blocky, straight against curves like the wood stuff.
So magical, what did you call it? Magical forest chic?
Or enchanted forest.
Enchanted forest chic.
So yeah, so where, so then where does that leave you now? Like, what are you working on now? What are the new projects? Where do you hope to continue to focus?
Okay. I really hope this continues this focus and just the wood. A lot of I would love to get back into self-producing, but now that we have two kids, that's really hindered my financial situation. I don't know if you guys have – I know you guys have kids, and anyone who has – I got two kids in daycare, and that is – that's basically just another mortgage payment.
Yeah, yep, for sure.
That we're just giving to the kids. So
you're lucky if you're only spending another mortgage payment.
It's a mortgage payment and a car payment. And we're talking, I got the itemized list this year for my taxes. And I can't believe how much money we pay in daycare. And that's why I don't really self-produce anymore. I'm mainly doing small micro ones where I can do in the garage. Or hopefully, you know, I like it when a company likes my work and they want to work and collaborate together on something. And I've been fortunate enough that Popper Toys is one of those companies, and they want to work together. So hopefully in the future we'll get that mini stag out there for people. And recently I have been working on minimizing a toy series that I did several years ago at Stranger Factory called Sentimentaries, and it was a larger scale, just childhood memories of playing on tree houses and, you know, half pipe ramps and whatnot, but I kind of personified them. So the half pipe is now like my childhood friend. He's grown legs. And so I'm kind of hoping that, you know, Papa and I are just kind of in the, you know, discussion stages of it, but maybe figuring out how we can do that in a mini series fashion, whether it's resin. It's too much work for me to do in wood, but I will be making them out of wood myself, and hopefully we can, you know, we'll send those off for casting. So hopefully in the next coming months, maybe 6 months to a year, maybe we'll start releasing one figure at a time there. So, and then coming up last year, series, I think it was series 5 Android.
Yeah.
I had two designs in there, but I never released the APs for it. And so I designed a letterpress print for that series, and probably in the next coming weeks I'll be releasing finally, after over a year, the APs for that Android 5 series.
That's cool. Exciting. I love the and by the way, I love the idea of the skate ramp, especially hearing like how the wood stuff kind of started. It seems like that's a thread that has just continued. So that's really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, all that was super personal to me, from climbing trees to the skate ramps. And originally, I'm an identical twins. So that skate ramp, what it is, it's going to be – actually, I can probably show you what the original looked like.
we're going on a little bit of a field trip right now.
So there's the original, and it's the half-pipe twins. And so that's a real personal piece to me, because me and my identical twin brother, we did everything together. And just all around surfing, skating.
Yeah.
And then be able to take, so if we do the mini series of it, what it is, you know, these two toys break apart and they're called the Half Pipe Twins, but you could buy it individually by itself, you know, and it'll be a cool figure by itself. But if you put them together, you'll be able to form a half pipe. And then up here is going to be like the, and this was like, this is my kids, you know, how you,
yeah.
Everyone had a box growing up, and a box is a kid's favorite toy, right? And so that's kind of what this is. This is my, you know, my two boys, and you know, you can crawl through the box and whatnot. So this is just a passion project for me. I really hope that, you know, me and Palmer can work on it together and do something, you know, really neat with it.
So this is the first time that I've really felt like the audio platform that we have on the podcast is hindering how cool this is. So, like, I think you're the first. Oh, wow! You're the first person to take us on a tour of their studio in podcast, and it's really, really cool, because I'm looking at these toys on your shelf and I'm thinking, it's like Christmas morning is celebrating Easter morning.
Yeah, I mean,
on your birthday, like that's what it feels like. It's just everything looks so cool.
Yeah, and this is the Autumn Stag, and this is the resin version that Popper produced. And I'm telling you, you cannot tell the difference between my original and this and resin version. So that's one reason I really want to continue working with Popper, because they, even though it might not be my wood, you know, actually wood.
Yeah.
Pops, you know, working with a factory that can emulate it to a, you know, down to a T, and it's just amazing the quality they got in that. So hopefully that works out.
Dude, that's pretty incredible. So we're going to be winding down, so you guys can go ahead and start getting your final questions in order. I have one to lead us into our final questions. And as you know, while we talk, a little peek behind the curtain. As you're talking, we are, you know, we're searching things. You're mentioning things. We're Googling it, and we've got our web pages up, and we're browsing these things as you're talking. And something struck me that I had not seen in any of my times looking at your stuff. And I've looked at a ton of your stuff. Talk to me about the Frank Kozik figure that you did that comes with the Labbit, and it comes with the mustachioed hand grenade, and It comes with all the different accessories. Talk to me about that figure, because I think it's pretty freaking incredible.
Okay, so basically I started out with the Super Suck Lord. 3D Retro ended up producing a vinyl toy based off of wood caricature I did of the Super Suck Lord. And basically I wanted to do an entire series of just the people within the designer toy scene, kind of pay homage to some of the more kind of recognizable characters in the scene. So yeah. Started out with Super Suck Lord, came home one day after seeing him at Designer Toy Con, whipped up a quick caricature that I could, you know, knock out of wood. And then I wanted to do enough accessories that kind of really lended. It wasn't just enough just to do the one character. I wanted to do a bunch of accessories that made up everything that is the Super Suck Lord. And so right after that, I was still feeling the vibe. So the next logical person, you know, seemed like Frank Kozik. So, again,
gotcha. Kinda,
you know, sketched him up. And I didn't know a whole lot about Frank before I did that. I just knew he did a crap load of toys. And so, wasn't like someone I really collected or anything. So, I had to do some research and, you know, I found out, you know, he ran a record company. And I noticed a lot of his designs use those old Preston Blair animation books. So I did, you know, one of the accessories was a Preston animation book, and another one was a record. And then he owns Bengal cats. So I made a Bengal cat accessory. So it was just tons of accessories. I think even the cigarette comes in and out of his mouth. And nice. So, yeah.
Did he love the figure?
I don't know. It's a tough guy to read. I think he did say he did like it, but originally when I didn't tell him I was doing it, and I do remember posting an image, I think, of the wood labbit, and I remember kind of getting like a, hey, you can't do that, or that's mine, or that's my property. It wasn't like an angry email or anything like that, but once I filled him in what I was doing, then he was really cool with it. And
does he have one on his shelf?
He does not own one, nope. They both went to good, really good homes, really good collectors. And I did give him some money.
Just to play nice.
Yeah. I mean, it just felt weird. I was gonna do the same thing with Super Suck Lord, but it ended up getting picked up as a vinyl toy.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he got paid, and, you know, having his first, because that was really the Super Suck Lord's first. I think, I don't know if it came out before his Dunny or not, but that was really, I think, Super Suck Lord's first real like vinyl production piece.
Cool.
So, you know, he was paid in product there, and then nothing ever came of the Kozik. Did I call it the Kozik kit?
Kozik kit. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, but yeah, that was a fun project. That was a good little.
You captured him. So obviously we've had him on the show before, and we can't read him
either. But he was really nice.
He was super nice, super cool guy, and he has
one tone. Yep, like always.
But you nailed it. I think you nailed his likeness, and you did a great job. All right, so we're gonna go into final questions here. Patrick, why don't you go ahead and take one?
I have this beautiful mental image right now. It's like late at night, maybe a fireplace flickering, and you're sitting in like your worn chair, and you've got your feet propped up, and you're knitting a Sylvan. Please tell me this is how it works.
Oh yeah, I mean it's all romantic setting for me. Dim lights, we got some, you know, slow music going on in the background. Yep.
Do you have you actually you make the plush versions yourself or?
Here's the thing, my first plush I ever did, I got invited to a show by Julie West. It was at, where was it? Dragatoni. And so Julie reached out and said, hey, I'm going to do a plush show. Would you like to be a part of it? And I love plush. I love plush design, but have never done it before. So I did start learning how to plush. I bought a couple books. I mean, I did hand stitch all of the Wooper Looper ones. I think I did maybe a total of 7 Wooper Looper ones. But I'm no professional. You know, those are extremely, you look at them and they're very handmade by someone who just picked up a book and learned how to make.
I'm sorry, did you just say they're very ham-made?
Oh, ham-made. Come on now. Come on.
Have a slide whistle sound there.
But no, like when the Sylvan and the Hermes and even Flat Bonnie did a collaboration with her, and that was all done through the Hermes and the Sylvan. Very lucky and unfortunate to work with Lana Crooks on that, and I just gave her carte blanche. I didn't. She was familiar with my product. Whatever she did with it, however she redesigned it, I didn't care. You know, that was part of the collaboration, is you do your thing with it. And the same thing with Flat Bonnie. You know, here's my character, the Wooper Looper. You take it, and whatever you do with it, you know, you run with it. So
the Sylvan, while it definitely does not, it's a different take on it, right? Because it's not blocky, it's not whatever. But it still very much is that character. But you can tell it also has inspiration from the artist that did it. And I think that that's a really cool way of collaborating. Because you're that's like a true collaboration, allowing their art to interject with your art, and kind of this amalgamation of the two. I think that's a great example of it, and it's super cute. I mean, I have the Sylvan, and I think it's just an awesome desk piece. And I love plush too, but I think it's super cute in a totally different way.
Awesome, thanks.
So my final question is, kind of more in the lines of like what's next for you, or if this is even on the radar for you, any kind of licensing that you would be interested in getting into for either the worlds that you've created or working with another company in doing your style for them?
Nothing in the works that I know of, but certainly not opposed to it. Whether, you know, a company wanted to contact me and design my version of pop culture's characters, you know, I'm on board with that. Or because I have dabbled in that. I love pop culture, and I have done a few pop culture items, from tackling, you know, Nosferatu to
Monster Totem and stuff.
I did a Teen Wolf piece.
Yeah,
Monster Totem. I did Teen Wolf, you know, Back to the Future. Yeah, I had this whole idea of just doing a Siamese series, and it was all pop culture based, but you would have in one figure, in a Siamese figure, it might be, you know, Luke on one side and Darth on the other side.
Sure.
And, you know, but yeah, certainly nothing on that I know of in the pipeline, but so.
It just, as I look through like what you've been doing, and it's cool. It's cool talking to customizers, and we've had people like, Huck on, and you guys are world builders. So you can definitely see your style and translates into these pieces and these collections you create. And I would love to see your version of something licensed from another world that, you know, we all know. So.
And that's kind of what I'm hoping with, you know, the sentimentaries. I do remember one year in the Nickelodeon stopped by, and they just, the creative director just really loved the sentimentaries. We never got anything, you know, off the ground with that or anything, and I don't, you know, I never pitched it to them, but she was just so in love with the concept of the sentimentaries. So, you know, maybe one day, you know, that could be a potential licensed product. I don't know.
Cool. That would be sweet. I'd be all over that. So,
like license, you know, the half pipe with the Bones Brigade or something like that. Maybe I can contact them and get a Bones Brigade version or something like that. We'll see.
That would be super rad. So my final question is just simply this. You saw this 13 years ago, and you just kind of picked it up. And I think your first piece was you customized something, right? It wasn't a build. What do you say to a person? And you're 13 years later, and you've worked with all sorts of other artists. Your stuff is all over the place. You've been featured and interviewed by multiple industry leading magazines and companies and organizations. What do you say to a person who's out there and is thinking about picking up a toy, is really interested in the toy world, doesn't know where to start? What would you say to that person?
Okay, well, do it. The way I did it, because what I did is I just went full-fledged right into designing a toy, went to China, and self-produced it. And, you know, I was not established. I was not, by any means had any sort of cred in the toy scene. And that was just a guy having built up a lot of savings, and I wanted to fulfill a dream of producing a toy. And so I would say if you're going to get into toys, do it for the right reasons. reason. It's not a money-based thing. It's definitely all passion. It's all passion project. And I would say develop up the establishment of your brand a little bit before you just jump full-fledged into a production. Do a lot of customs. Anything that comes your way, don't say no, because you never know what that's going to lead to. You might do a custom and that might lead into a production toy from that, or it's just going to get yourself noticed and you're going to get into more shows. And that's kind of how I think I got noticed a little bit more. My first toy didn't get me a lot of press by any means, but I think it got me some invitations to some custom shows.
Sure. Yeah.
And then I started doing more customs. And I think that's kind of how that steamrolled a little bit. So I would say just keep at it. Don't do it for money. And, you know, if you are spending money, think of a way that you can break even to roll into the next project. And, you know, and I hate to say there is a networking aspect to it. So, you know, go to DesignerCon, go to, you know, San Diego, meet the other artists, jump on the forums. You definitely got to be on the social networks, and that's really how the best way to kind of establish and get your name out there.
Yeah, well, I think that's perfect. So before we head out of here, I want to give you an opportunity to tell people where they can find you, where they can support you, they can give you money, they can buy some things and see your work.
Okay, well, my Instagram account is Gary Ham. I pretty primarily just post directly through that. Twitter is Gary Geppetto. And coming in the next, I think, week or two, I'll be doing a podcast series called the Marsham Toy Hour, where we'll be discussing past and current events within toys. There's going to be three of us, me, Aaron over at Martian Toys and GM of the Blind Box podcast.
Nice.
And we kind of represent, yeah, it's, you know, we just shot the first episode last night, and I think it's going to be a fun little show because we have each bring a different side designer toys. I kind of bring the more artist customizer aspect. Aaron is going to be bringing store owner, toy producer aspect to it. And GM, he's a podcaster, but he's also really new to collecting. So he's going to bring the kind of collector newbie aspect to it. And,
nice.
And then we'll, you know, hopefully we'll do more of a round table and we'll have guest artists come in. So hopefully people start following blindboxpodcast.com. And hopefully in the coming weeks, you know, there'll be another avenue to, you know, follow me and learn more about designer toys. And you guys, you know, big shout out to you guys, because podcasting seems to really have just popped up on the scene the last couple months. When you guys talked to me at San Diego in July, I wasn't even really aware of the podcasting world. And since then, I mean, it's been all podcasts for me. I don't listen to music at work anymore. I just, you know, it's all podcasts for me, from listening to you guys and to the other, you know, podcasts out there. And so thank you for doing what you guys do and really helping bring a voice to designer toys. You know, the blogs are great, but you guys are actually like giving a personality to the toys. And thank you for that.
Hey, Nate, no problem.
Appreciate it.
Honestly, it's our pleasure. So we want to thank you for being on the show. A couple things before we go, though. Will you draw some tokens for us?
Definitely.
Perfect. Okay, so then what we're going to do is we're going to head out of the interview portion of the show and move into tokens. All right, so the tokens portion of every show is when we decide what we're going to talk about the following week. It's what gives us the topics for what we're going to talk about. And so this week, Gary is going to choose them for us. So I'm going to go ahead and shuffle these up. We've got, you know, our three tokens in my hand, and you're going to pick between one and three. And this one's going to be for old Luke Face.
Ready? Two.
Two?
Yeah.
Two.
Luke, you got TV and film, my friend.
All right.
Okay, and then pick between one and two, and that will be for Patrick.
I want art.
Go one.
One? You got toys and games, sucker.
Oh, my gosh.
That means I got art and design again. Thank you so much for that, Gary. Hey,
you're welcome.
Seriously, thanks for being on the episode. We're gonna head out, but we have so much more to talk with you about. With so many more times that I feel like maybe with the new podcast coming up and everything, maybe we can do some crossover stuff. There's so much more to talk to you about. Your style is rad, and you're just a really cool guy. But for us, if you want to find us, you can find us on mofonepodcast.com, where you can find show notes and links to all the stuff we talked about in this episode, and you can sign up to get on our Extra Bits newsletter. Now, here's the deal. Next week, and what, 2 weeks next week and the week after that. So we have 2.5 weeks left for you to get involved in the M of One customized contest. And this is a contest you are going to want to be a part of. Get out there, get a toy. Maybe you already have a toy. Maybe it's a blank. Maybe it's something else. Maybe it's something cheap, whatever. Take it, paint it, cut it up, chop it up, whatever it is you're going to do to it, customize that toy, and post images of it to enter the contest. Hashtag M of One Customized. Now, when you do that, you are entering into an opportunity to win some incredible figures from our guests who are going to be on this month. And so you don't want to miss out on that. Honestly, this is going to be – if I could enter this contest, I would, but I don't think I'm allowed to win.
You're not allowed.
Yeah, I figured Luke would be the one who would say no because he's the rule follower. But this is the time to jump in. So if you've got friends who customize, if you've got friends who like to like make stuff, turn them on to this. It's going to be a good time, and honestly, it's just fun. So make sure you do that. You can also find us on social media. Just search M of One Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and on Elo as well. We have personal social media. Luke, what's yours?
Luke Gall on Instagram, Twitter, and Elo.
And Patrick?
The Great Patsby on Instagram. That's with two A's. And probably on Elo, P-Hill, PhD.
You're getting more sultry when you say that.
It is. It's like way drawn out.
I practice. It's like in the car. It's like
you're sipping Kentucky bourbon when you're just sitting on a like a front porch swing and it just slowly meanders out your mouth.
That would be like a good like vocal, like an auditory password, like to get into a vault. Like you would be the only one.
Yeah, it's up to five A's now. It's just gonna keep getting longer.
And Gary, just remind everybody where you're at on the socials.
Okay, Gary Heim on Instagram and Facebook, and Gary Geppetto on Twitter.
Nice,
awesome. And I'm at Andrew Sale with threes instead of E's all across the board. You can find me there. Guys, we're out of here. It's been an awesome time talking with Gary. And until next time, we're out of here. I'm Andrew.
I'm Patrick.
I'm Luke.
And I'm Gary.
Peace out.
Bye.
Hold on to your butts.
Hey, toy family, this is Gary Ham. You're listening to the Master of One podcast. You can reach me over at Instagram at Gary Ham or my website, superham.com.